The Church and the Poor by Robert C. Newman. Many have dismissed the problem of poverty with Jesus' quotation, quote, "The poor you have always," quote, Matthew 26:11 and parallels, as though believers have no responsibilities here. But Jesus added, as we see in Mark, "Whenever you wish, you can do them good." Here we want to look at the whole problem of poverty and what Christians can and should do about it. Let's divide up our discussion into two major areas. First, causes of poverty and prosperity, and second, responsibilities of Christians. Under the first of these headings, we will look at causes in the forms of pairs of opposites, things that cause poverty and the opposite which can lead to prosperity, etc. So, let's look first of all then at causes of poverty and prosperity. What we call the first pair of causes, if you like, laziness and diligence. And we're going to look at, in each of these cases, a few passages, biblical passages. This one we've got lots of from Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, but we'll just look at a selection of them. So Proverbs 6:6-11. "Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider its ways and be wise. It has no commander, no overseer or ruler. Yet it stores up its provisions in summer and gathers its food in harvest. How long will you lie there, you sluggard? When will you get up from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a bandit, and scarcity like an armed man." So an exhortation by Solomon to one who is lazy, a sluggard, and suggests that you could learn a good lesson from the ants. They don't need somebody driving them all the time to work, but they do what needs to be done. They get their provisions when the time to get them is good. And on the other hand, a sluggard, a lazy person, thinking that they just need a little sleep, a little slumber, but poverty will overtake them like a bandit, scarcity like an armed man. Well, Proverbs 10:4-5. "Lazy hands make a man poor, but diligent hands bring wealth. He who gathers crops in summer is a wise son, but he who sleeps during harvest is a disgraceful son." So here you have this rather common set of opposites in the book of Proverbs. The opposites are laziness and diligence, and the results are poverty and wealth. Now, the book of Proverbs is not a book that tells you what invariably will happen, but what will tend to happen, other things being equal. And so it would be rather like a set of physical laws, if you like, that if you drop something, it will let go of something in a gravitational field, it will tend to drop towards the source of that field, if you like, and such. But there are things that can intervene and such. But here, this is telling you then that laziness tends to poverty and diligence tends to wealth. Two more Proverbs, 14:23 and 21:5. 14:23, "All hard work brings a profit, but mere talk leads only to poverty." The difference between doing and just talking. Right? And then 21:5, "The plans of the diligent lead to profit, as surely as haste leads to poverty." Here suggesting haste, probably in the sense of a lazy haste, wanting to get something done and out of the way. And so it's going to produce poverty. The book of Ecclesiastes has a more sobering outlook to it, since it suggests that finally death brings an end to all these things, and whether you're rich or poor, in the final end you're still going to die, etc. But it still has a number of proverbs in it, and those proverbs do make some of the same points that we see in the book of Proverbs. So Ecclesiastes 4:5 and Ecclesiastes 9:10. "The fool folds his hands and it ruins himself," so it brings disaster by not doing anything. And then 9:10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For in the grave where you're going, there's neither working nor planning nor knowledge nor wisdom. Author of Ecclesiastes, I believe Solomon, is saying that whatever you're going to get done in this life, you need to do it now. It's not going to get done in the grave, and suggests that there's something perhaps unique about this life. And Solomon does not unpack what that is, but from Christian perspective, we can see in some sense what that is. This will be the only opportunity you will have to labor in the midst of your own sinful tendencies and to struggle against the temptations of Satan and the blandishments of the world and things of that sort. So that's the first pair of causes, if you like, poverty caused by laziness and prosperity caused by diligence. Another set of these pairs, if you like, are extravagance and thrift, whether you're a spender or whether you're very cautious. And again, we look at some Proverbs. Proverbs 12:27 and 21:17. 12:27, the lazy man does not roast his game, but the diligent man prizes his possessions. This is one of these somewhat puzzling proverbs, and you have to think, well, what's the point that the writer is making about lazy man not roasting his game? And I think you see that from the other side. The diligent man prizes his possessions. The lazy man doesn't prize his possessions. And so he's killed some, say, deer or something of that sort, and wastes it, rather than seeing that it's prepared so he can eat it, if you like. And the contrast on the diligent side is that this person cares a good deal about what he's got and is not going to waste it, if you like. And here's a rather interesting proverb then. It actually picks up these two things, so laziness and diligence that we've just looked at, and also extravagance and thrift. The lazy person here is extravagant. He wastes this animal that he has shot, and the diligent man prizes his possessions. And then 21:17, he who loves pleasure will become poor. Whoever loves wine and oil will never be rich. Basically saying that it's possible to be so desiring of pleasure that you waste all your money on it. Okay? Possible to so desire wine and oil features in the Middle Eastern economy that would be connected with pleasure, if you like, and that will interfere with your being rich. You'll use up your surplus, if you like, on your pleasures rather than storing it up, if you like. Proverbs 21:20 and Proverbs 23:20-21. 21:20, in the house of the wise are stores of choice food and oil, but a foolish man devours all he has. And here we see one of the contrasts of extravagance and thrift, if you like, that the foolish man devours all he has. He does not store up anything, so he's extravagant in that sense, whereas the thrifty person here, pictured as wise, stores up good food and oil, if you like, so that he's got that when he needs it, if you like. 23, 20, and 21. Do not join those who drink too much wine or gorge themselves on meat, for drunkards and gluttons become poor, and drowsiness clothes them in rags. So it's possible to expend what you may need later by being a drunkard and a glutton. And the result is that you will one day be clothed in rags. The implication then is that you're cautious, you store things up, you become wealthy. And if you're not cautious, you are extravagant, you will waste it all. So that's a second pair of causes. Extravagance tends toward poverty, and thrift tends towards wealth. A third cause, disobedience versus obedience, if you like. Well, here, this is a rather major theme in connection with God's covenant in the Old Testament. And we have in two passages in the Bible the blessing and curse passages of God's covenant with Israel. In Leviticus chapter 26, verses 3 through 13 are the blessings that will come for keeping the covenant, and 14 through 33 the curses which will come from not keeping the covenant. And then in Deuteronomy 28 have a somewhat similar thing, with verses 1 through 14 the blessings that will come for keeping the covenant, and verses 15 through 16 a big passage of the curses that will come for not keeping it. There's a kind of a hint here of how things are going to work out in the history of Israel in having such a longer passage on the curses than there are on the blessings. Now we look at some samples of both of these passages and both sides in both passages here in what follows. So Leviticus 26, 3 through 5. If you follow my decrees and are careful to obey my commands, says God, I will send you rain in a season, and the ground will yield its crops, and the trees of the field their fruit. Your threshing will continue to grape harvest, and your grape harvest will continue to planting, and you will eat all the food you want, and live in safety in your land. So God is setting out for the Israelites a certain promise that if they're faithful to him, he will be faithful to them in these things that we would consider to be wealth, if you like, enjoyable things. On the other hand, 26:19 through 20, we're in the section already of if you're not faithful, and God says, I will break down your stubborn pride and make the sky above you like iron and the ground beneath you like bronze. Drought, huh? Your strength will be spent in vain because your soil will not yield its crops, nor will the trees of the land yield their fruit. So God, who is the one who controls the weather, if you like, though he may perfectly well use, and I believe he does, use intermediate means to do that, is here promising to the Israelites, on the one hand, blessing if they're faithful in the whole climate situation, and on the other hand, curses if they're not faithful. And that continues on in verse 26. When I cut off your supply of bread, 10 women will be able to bake your bread in one oven, whereas presumably they would need an oven apiece otherwise, and they will dole out the bread by weight rationing. You will eat, but you will not be satisfied. So that's the blessing and curses, some small samples out of Leviticus 26. In Deuteronomy 28, verses 4 and 5, we see that it's also in the area of childbearing and such. The fruit of your womb will be blessed, and the crops of your land, and the young of your livestock, the calves of your herds, and the lambs of your flocks. Your basket and your kneading trough will be blessed. So God promises to bless both the families of the Israelites and their produce, both livestock and the grains, if you like. 28:8, the Lord will send a blessing on your barns, your storage facilities, and on everything you put your hand to. The Lord will bless you in the land he is giving you. So very general promise of blessing. On the other hand, Deuteronomy 28, 17, 18, and 20, your basket and kneading trough will be cursed. Okay, so if you're not faithful, it'll be cursed, and if you are faithful, it'll be blessed. The fruit of your womb will be cursed, and the crops of your land, and the calves of your herds, and the lambs of your flocks. So kind of just a mirror image of verses 4 and 5. And then in verse 20, the Lord will send on you curses, confusion, and rebuke in everything you put your hand to, until you're destroyed and come to sudden ruin because the evil you have done in forsaking him. So the Bible's very clear that another cause of poverty is disobedience to God, and that another cause of wealth is obedience to God. This was given, first of all, to the Israelites, but I think there is warrant for suggesting that, in general, this is the same sort of thing that one could find then in other nations where they seek to do what is right, and where believers in the various societies in which they're located seek to do what is right. Another cause of poverty and of wealth is what we could call disaster and blessing. We've already seen some of the blessing in connection with the previous verses in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. And we, in reading over the whole of Scripture, we need to be aware that disaster and blessing are not necessarily related to one's wickedness or goodness. So although the Proverbs seem to move in that direction, and the blessings and covenants of the curse seem to move in that direction, there are other things that can come in. And some examples of that in Job chapters 1 and 2. Job is impoverished by overwhelming disaster, yet we are told that he is the most righteous man of his generation. And in Psalm 73 verses 3 through 14, we see that the wicked sometimes prosper. So disaster and blessing, kind of independent of how you're living your life, can bring, on the one hand, poverty, disaster, and on the other hand, wealth, blessing. We move on to another set of causes. Persecution in general, or we might say the act of being persecuted and the act of persecuting, and I'm going to look mainly at the receiving side of this. Many of the passages on persecution and such deal with imprisonment or death, but some of the others, Job 1 and 2, which we just saw in the previous section, Job is devastated by disaster, etc. But as we read the story and we see the behind-the-scenes situation, the unseen world, heaven, we see that Job is actually devastated by an unseen persecution from Satan, with the implication that a lot of the disaster that occurs in the lives of people may very well be persecution by Satan. In Romans 8:35, hardship, famine, nakedness, etc. are spoken of in a persecution context. And in 1 Corinthians 4:9-13, that's explicitly applied to the apostles who are hungry and thirsty and in rags. Let's take a quick look at each of these three passages. Job 1:9-11, Satan has appeared before God, and God has said, "Have you seen my servant Job? There's no one like him," etc. And Satan replies, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You bless the work of his hands, so his flocks and herds are spread out throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." So we see in this kind of situation that what Job is getting is unseen persecution. That is, the results are very clear, but that it's coming from an enemy of his is not obvious to Job. And its purpose is that Satan is claiming Job is good just because he's rewarded for it, and if you take away the reward, he will curse you to your face. And the main theme, if you like, of the book of Job is that that turns out to be wrong, and that Job really does fear God, love God, because of who God is, though Job has to struggle with some things before he realizes that. Romans 8:35, Paul says, speaking to believers in Rome, "Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall trouble or hardship or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword?" So he's saying these things we're all going to face. We're going to face all these things, but God is going to keep us, if you like. And then he says in verse 36, "As it is written," he quotes Psalm 44:22, "For your sake we face death all day long. We're considered as sheep to be slaughtered." So you can have disaster coming on good people because of persecution, and that's what we see here. We see something similar in 1 Corinthians 4:9-13, where Paul is contrasting how the Corinthians are getting along, who seem to be rather prosperous at this point, and the difficulties the apostles are facing. He says, "For it seems to me that God has put us apostles on display at the end of the procession, like men to condemn to die in the arena." He's giving a little picture of prisoners at the end of a Roman triumph, if you like, here. "We have been made a spectacle to the whole universe, to angels as well as to men. We are fools for Christ, but you are so wise in Christ." He's contrasting this prosperity, if you like, of some of the Corinthians who are looking down their nose at Paul and the other apostles. "We are weak, but you are strong. You are honored, we are dishonored. To this very hour we go hungry and thirsty. We're in rags, we are brutally treated, we're homeless. We work hard with our own hands. When we are cursed, we bless. When we are persecuted, we endure it. When we are slandered, we answer kindly. Up to this moment, we have become the scum of the earth, the refuse of the world. So, this whole area of persecution is a situation in which those who are persecuted can be become poor, and those who are the persecutors can sometimes become rich out of that. Haven't looked any passages here, but you look through history, you see that's often the case, that the persecutors will seize the property of those they are persecuting. Something similar is being oppressed and oppressing. We looked at some of these phenomena under the category of persecuted and persecuting. But many become poor just because they're weak and the strong oppress them, not because they're necessarily good or necessarily believers, but just because they're weak. And others become rich because they are both powerful and unscrupulous, and they oppress the weak. So Proverbs 28, verses 3 through 6. A ruler who oppresses the poor is like a driving rain that leaves no crops. Those who forsake the law praise the wicked, but those who keep the law resist them. Evil men do not understand justice, but those who seek the Lord understand fully. Better a poor man whose walk is blameless than a rich man whose ways are perverse. So oppression is going to occur, okay? And you need to be aware of that. In Ecclesiastes 5, 8, 9, Solomon gives us some insight into how governments often work. If you see the poor oppressed in a district, and justice and rights denied, do not be surprised at such things. For one official is eyed by a higher one. Over them both are others higher still. The increase from the land is taken by all. The king himself profits from the fields. The picture here of a, at that point, probably of a royal government at that point, a monarchy of some sort, but this has been common in all sorts of governments, is that the people in political power oppress those under them and get rich by oppressing those who are under them as well. In Ezekiel 22, 29, and 30, we see a characterization of the situation in Israel at Ezekiel's time, near the end of the southern kingdom, so 600s BC and into the 500s. The people of the land, says Ezekiel, practice extortion and commit robbery. They oppress the poor and needy and mistreat the alien, denying them justice. That's God speaking, actually, through Ezekiel. I looked for a man among them who would build up the wall and stand before me in the gap on behalf of the land so I would not have to destroy it, but I found none. So I will pour out my wrath on them and consume them in my fiery anger, bringing down on their heads, on their own heads, all they have done, declares the Sovereign Lord. So this one passage not only shows that oppression occurs, but that God will intervene to deal with that sort of thing. And that intervention will not finally be worked out until the last judgment, so beyond this life. But again and again, we see it worked out in this life when God allows something to happen that destroys the oppressors. And sometimes it is just to trade one set of oppressors for another, but that's how it often goes in this life. Amos 5, 11, and 12. God, speaking through the prophet Amos, says to his hearers, you trample on the poor and force them to give you grain. Therefore, though you have built stone mansions, you will not live in them. Though you have planted lush vineyards, you will not drink their wine. For I know how many are your offenses and how great your sins. You oppress the righteous and take bribes, and you deprive the poor of justice in the courts. So, again, the picture here is God is watching all of this, and indication that God may very well intervene. In James 2, verses 6 and 7, here's the Apostle James speaking to his readers, or actually James, the Lord's brother, speaking to his readers, members of Jewish Christian assemblies somewhere in the Greco-Roman world. And it suggests that when they show favoritism towards rich visitors over poor visitors who come to their congregation, he says, "You have insulted the poor. Is it not the rich who are exploiting you? Are they not the ones who are dragging you into court? Are they not the ones who are slandering the noble name of him to whom you belong?" etc. So he's saying, you know, it's the rich people who are the ones that take you into court, and it's the rich ones who exploit you, and it's rich ones who slander Christ, etc. So that's the picture we see then of the oppression, and being oppressed, you become poor, and oppressing, you become rich. Pull together a summary on these causes. We see that poverty can be caused by laziness, can be caused by extravagance, by disobedience to God's law, by disasters overtaking one, by persecution coming upon one, by oppression by others who are stronger than us. So, not all poverty is due to the sin of the poor, but clearly some of it is. And so that's something that needs to be kept in mind. And the question then is, how are Christians to respond? So that's what we want to have a look at here, the responsibilities of Christians. Well, my suggestion here is two broad areas as well, which we'll unpack. First, don't do any of the things that make for poverty in yourself or make for poverty in others. And two, be a redemptive force to work against poverty in the situations that you come in contact with. So let's start with the first one. Don't do what makes for poverty. And I divide up my suggestions here, exhortations here, into certain broad categories, which I'll unpack a little bit then. So the first one of these is encourage diligence. Be diligent in your own work. Encourage diligence in others by word and example. Don't give to others in such a way as to discourage diligence. Requires some wisdom in all of these things. Huh? Secondly, be thrifty. Be thrifty with your wealth, whatever it is. Fight waste and extravagance in your home, your church, your job, your government. And be thrifty even in your benevolence. A couple of passages that might illustrate some of these things. Paul says to the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians 3:10, "Even when we were with you, we gave you this rule. If a man will not work, he shall not eat." Basically saying, you need to help the poor if you can. But if a person is able to work and is not doing it, you should not be supporting him. Right? So basically a picture of a working welfare of some sort. And we realize that there are people who are in such bad shape physically and such that they can't work. But this needs to be applied, huh? Luke 10:33-35, Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, a fellow who had just been waylaid by thieves and stripped and left half dead. And when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, took him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 silver coins. Margin there tells us these are Greek denarii. these are denarii. And gave them to the innkeeper. "Look after him," he said, "and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have." So here the Samaritan involves himself in helping this guy at some danger, and at some expenditure of his time and some expenditure of money. And he probably knows the innkeeper. I gather that the Samaritan, since this is a road between Jerusalem and Jericho, so not in Samaria, that the Samaritan is some kind of perhaps a business traveler and is used to this. He trusts the innkeeper to look after this guy, but funds him to do that. And he says he's thrifty here. He doesn't just give him a huge amount of money, but this is not trivial. This is a 2 days' wage for a day laborer anyway, and it may take more than that to bring the guy back to health. But the fellow promises, when I return, I'll reimburse you. So it's not a blank check, but it's not stingy either. So those are 2 points then of how we should deal with this whole question of don't do what makes for poverty. That is that we are to encourage diligence and we're to be thrifty. And now two more. Be obedient. Be obedient to God's word, to God's law, okay? Encourage others to be obedient also. And work for government obedience to God's law. Living in a secular society, we cannot expect that our government is going to be obedient to God's law and everything, but we should use our influence to see that they're obedient to it in as many areas as we can get them to be so, I think is probably fair to say. We do have to recognize that we live in a society unlike Israel, in which there are people with very different religious and moral views and such, and we need to get along with them to the extent we can, but that does not mean letting acts that are hugely detrimental to society just go as okay if we have anything to do with it. Huh? And the other suggestion here, don't oppress. Don't oppress others, and oppose those who do so, whether they do it privately or through business or government activities. That's one way in which we are to resist the wicked. So those are the suggestions here for how Christians ought to respond. We should encourage diligence, we should be thrifty, we should be obedient, and we should not oppress. On top of that, we should seek to be a redemptive force. And we suggest several things here as well. First, use your surplus to help others in emergency. And there are a number of scriptural passages here, which I'll let you look at sometime if you have the opportunity. Ephesians 4:28, end of Acts 4 and the beginning of Acts 5, 2 Corinthians 8, first 15 verses, and Luke 10, verses 30 through 37. Use your surplus to help others in emergencies. One of the responsibilities that Christians have, I think, is to, well, that's the next point, actually. So, first of all, use your surplus to help others in emergency. And then two, try to do without in order to have more surplus to help others. Don't be extravagant. Don't be using up all your surplus on yourself. Right? But in order to be one who loves their neighbors as themselves and one who loves God as with all their being, we need to have a sober and thrifty lifestyle in order to have more surplus to help others. And I give you some passages there. Matthew 25, 34 to 40, the sheep and the goat judgment. As much as you have done these to the least of my brothers, you've done this to me. Matthew 6 in the Sermon on the Mount, and Luke 3:11. And then thirdly, encourage your church to devote a scriptural level of attention to benevolence. And Acts 6 and 2 Timothy 5 are samples of this in the New Testament. We need to get our church to think about the question of benevolence, helping out people who are hurting, widows, orphans, etc. And yes, in some countries the government will do a good bit, and but even where the government is doing a good bit, sometimes the way it is done is not really the best way to help these people. And so we need to encourage our church to think that through and try and do what we can there. Further on in being a redemptive force, encourage those works which are helping the poor to get on their feet and reform their own lifestyle. World Magazine has recently had a number of articles, and they've actually got kind of a contest each year now of which ministries are really having the most effective redemptively, if you like, in the sense of helping the poor to get on their feet and reform their own lifestyle. And lastly, I suggest work against societal practices which lead to poverty. And I'm going to list three here that people may not like to hear. And I'm not saying that these are always wrong or anything like that, but that they have tendencies that will lead people into poverty, and we need to try and discourage that sort of thing from happening. First of all, is advertising. You don't have to think a few minutes and watch a few TV ads to realize that advertising encourages covetousness, which is a sin. It encourages you to long after to lust for things that you don't have, and it's also an encouragement to consumption, to get rid of the old stuff and get the latest stuff, etc. And those are things that really eat up any surplus you might have that could be used to help others. And so we, at least to the extent that we are in charge of advertising for some business, or that we're in charge of a business and we need to think about what kind of advertising we want to do, we would want to try and have the kind of advertising that does not encourage covetousness and does not encourage unnecessary consumption. The second thing is credit. There's a place for credit, but credit can encourage indebtedness, and that basically means you've got a negative surplus, that you get into debt a ways, and you're using up your surplus to pay your indebtedness, even to pay the interest on your indebtedness. And again, it also, credit and indebtedness is betting that circumstances will be good in the future, and that you won't, the economy won't crash on you, etc. And I think one thing we can say from looking at human history is the economy will crash. It may take a while. You may luck it out, you think. But we need to live our lives in such a way that we're prepared for a certain amount of disaster. You could say, well, I prepare myself for disaster by insurance, and that brings up the third thing I want to mention. And there's a place for insurance. Insurance, in some sense, is a commercial way, if you like, of the people who pay for the insurance helping the people who, among those who have paid, who have a disaster once would occur, and the insurance helps cover that. There's a place for that. But insurance can produce a feeling of false security that you're protected by the wealth of this company, etc. And it can encourage waste in one sort of one sort or another, that these things will be paid back, and so you don't need to worry about it, and you don't need to use the carefulness that a person would otherwise use if they didn't have this sort of insurance, if you like. Well, so be a redemptive force, and we suggest use your surplus to help others in emergencies. Try to do without in order to have more surplus to help others. Encourage your church to devote a scriptural level of attention to benevolence, and encourage those works which are helping the poor to get on their feet and reform their own lifestyle, and work against societal practices which lead to poverty. Before we end, a quick bibliography. I've been helped by Ronald Sider's book, Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger. He has some very good things to say that are very scriptural, it seems to me. There's some things where I'm not so well satisfied with the way he goes, and some of those are dealt with, I think, by David Chilton in his book, Productive Christians in an Age of Guilt Manipulators. But I think Chilton, in some ways, comes across in ways that I'm dissatisfied with as well. So I would suggest that you read both of these and read them with discernment and test them against Scripture. But they can give you some stuff to think about that you might not have thought about. John Jefferson Davis's book, Your Wealth in God's World, is helpful here as well as Carl Kreider's book, The Christian Entrepreneur. There are doubtless other books out there, but those are four that I've read that I have found helped me. Well, that's the end of our quick discussion on the church and the poor. And my suggestion as we close is not to forget Matthew 25, verses 40 and 45. That's where Jesus sums up his remarks to the sheep and the goats, if you like, at the judgment. And the sheep are the ones who have cared for those around them. and the goats are the one who have not. And Jesus basically said, inasmuch if you've done this, cared or not cared, for the least of these my brethren, you have done this, cared or not cared, to me. And we need to keep that in mind whenever we think about the status of poor people around us. Thank you very much for your attention.